Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Hi, folks. This is Mark Anthony Rossi with the show A Strength to Be Human. It's another interview segment and another interesting and exciting one. So I'm very happy to welcome to the show Anne Welsh Donnelly. She's an Irish a poet, meaning actually from Ireland. And she has an incredible story about her life and her work and how those intertwine. So I want to welcome you, Anne. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. So I know, and I'm sure the audience already knows, too, that oftentimes it's necessary to sort of get a better idea of where the person wants to go on to the show and sort of a bit of the backstory. Even though we're not a show that has canned questions or rehearsals, it's always important to at least have a general idea of a direction so that no one's surprised. Because on radio, if you're totally surprised on this end of things, then it becomes a problem rather than it just being organic and authentic. So I know you have an incredible story, and we're definitely ready to hear it. And thank you very much for being so brave and so charitable to offer it and share it with us, Anne.
Okay, thanks very much, Mark. So maybe just talk first about how I started to write.
Yes, that sounds great.
I started writing 7 years ago, and it was 2 years after I had separated from my husband. I was in therapy because I was trying to deal with being separated and being single parent of two children. So I had been in therapy, and as part of the therapy, I wanted to show my therapist in some way, or to thank her in some way, for all that she had done for me. And so I decided to write her a poem to thank her. I hadn't written before, but I enjoyed the process of writing the poem. It was just an enjoyable experience, just even writing it. And when I gave it to her, she was delighted, and she said to me, "You have to continue to write." And that was it. That's what started it. I think it was a combination of actually sitting down and writing something. It just took me out of the stresses of everyday life. And it was like, if I couldn't sleep at night time, I just got the pen and paper and started writing. And it was just therapy initially, very therapeutic. And the fact that then when I did give it to my therapist and her reaction, it kind of just inspired me to write more. So I did an online course in poetry at the time, and I went to some classes in my local college as well. And it just took off, and I started writing short stories and short plays, which I enjoyed. I kind of didn't think I was any good at poetry, so I kind of left that to one side. So I started writing short stories and short plays. The first short play I actually wrote was performed locally in a festival here in Mayo. And it's funny because it was about a gay man coming out to his father. And I noticed in my writing over the first couple of years that the constantly gay characters were popping up in my stories and in my plays. Didn't really think much of it at the time. I just kind of looked and said, "Oh, that's interesting. I'm writing a lot about gay characters. I wonder why." But kind of, it wasn't something I was exploring. Looking back now, obviously, I was exploring being gay through my characters unconsciously. So it was safer for me to live vicariously through my characters and explore being gay through them. Now, looking back, I can see that at the time, I didn't know why. It was just, I just was just writing these stories. So about two and a half years ago, I got very sick, and I became very depressed. So I stopped writing. There was no joy in life. There was no goodness in it. I had no motivation for writing. All I could do was basically get out of bed in the morning, get the kids up for school, go to work, come home, cook dinner, put them to bed, go to bed myself. There was no room for anything else in life. There was no room for writing. It just the joy had gone out of it. So about maybe a month or so after, I started getting better, went on antidepressants, and it kind of stabilized. And it was then that poems started to come. They just kind of tumbled out of my head. And it was easier to write poems then because I hadn't got an awful lot of energy and I didn't have the energy to be writing a short story. Writing poem was easier because you could get it out on the page in half an hour and then you go back and you craft it and whatever else. But it was a lot easier for me to do that than to write a short story, which you need stamina for, and it's not going to happen. It takes a while to get a short story written. So that's the poem started coming. And poetry, I suppose, is different for me. It's different than a short story because most of the time in poetry, it's about yourself. Well, for me anyway, it tends to be about myself, whereas the short stories, you're kind of hiding behind your characters. But then a poem is kind of, okay, they can be about characters, but I suppose maybe 50% of what I write in poems is reflecting on my own life. So that's when, as that was happening, as I was writing the poems, and obviously the first two poems were all about the depression and recovering from the depression and all that. So it was like, again, it was therapy. But as I was writing poems at that time, 2 years ago, I became aware that I was attracted to women. It just became stronger. Now, I think it possibly became stronger because of the depression, which stripped me back to the bare bones. Like when you're depressed, you're not really worried about what anybody thinks. At least I wasn't worried about what anybody thinks. The only thing I was worried about was actually getting through the day and staying alive for my kids. That was my only concern in life. So suddenly I was stripped naked, for want of a better word. And it was like, you know, there was no pretense anymore. There was no mask. It was just basically surviving. So I think in tandem with that and coming out of that, suddenly I was looking at who am I? You know, what am I? What's my sexual orientation? And it was like rebuilding my life again. And part of that was realizing, oh, I am attracted to women. And okay, well, I wonder, is that why I'm writing about gay characters the whole time in my stories? And I brought it to therapy, explored it, and took a while to explore it and to come to terms with it and to accept it. But the wonderful thing was, as I was doing that and I was exploring the fact that I am gay, I was writing poems about it. So over the last 2 years, basically, I have documented my journey from being straight, as I perceive myself to be, to being gay. And the poems are like kind of like a what would you say, a record of my journey in the last 2 years. So that's where. That's what I did then was, once I got these poems, I wrote about 150 poems in the last 2 years. I went back over them and looked at them, and I realized in some of them there was a journey there. There's about 30 poems that I picked out that basically, you know, go from leaving the marriage to recovering from depression to looking at being gay, accepting that, and then coming out to family and friends. Being in a relationship, ending that, being in a relationship with a woman, and then being single again. And I had this collection of 29, 30 poems, and I decided to send them off to a publisher, which I did. And they're going to be published in May. So,
congratulations. That is exciting. But it's sounding to me that even though journey is a good inclusive word to everything, it also sounds like you're having like multiple journeys.
Absolutely. There's a journey from being married to being single and, you know, being a parent to two children, a single parent to two children. There was that journey. Then there was the journey where I was surviving for the first couple of years after the marriage breakup. Literally, it's survival, and that's all you're doing. And because I had to be there for the kids, I put my own needs aside, and it was just a case of doing what I had to do to pay the bills, keep the roof over our head, make sure they were doing okay. Obviously, trying to be supportive for them because it was they were only 6 and 8 at the time. So as you can imagine, it was horrendous for them.
I can imagine.
Yeah, we left the family home, so we moved to a new town, a new house, new school for them, new friends. So it was a huge, huge wrench. So I really had to be there for them, and my stuff had to kind of just take a back seat. And it was just all about making sure that they were coping okay. So that was kind of, you know, that was kind of a couple of years of work as ongoing. But and then it was like I was focusing so much on them and on work and on just keeping things going. Basically, I ran myself into the ground because I wasn't looking after me at all. And I know it's kind of a cliche nowadays, self-care, and it is a bit of a cliche, but it's necessary. And I learned the hard way.
Yeah, nope. It's not a cliche. Yeah. It's a common thing. But a few hours ago, I was talking to a friend of mine, who is a writer, but she also does missionary work for her church and does it seriously. Literally leaves to go abroad, and she was mentioning how blessed she was, but also how sometimes it takes so much from her that she just needs to step away and sort of recharge her battery. So even in those particular instances, the self-care or simply just the appreciation of who you are, it's critical. Otherwise, you burn yourself out.
Absolutely. And it's like, it took me to get very depressed for me to realize that, because I really realized suddenly, okay, if I don't put myself first, I'm not going to be alive. So the kids aren't going to have a mother. It came down to that kind of reality. So it was a case of, okay, I have to look after myself. If I'm tired, I have to go to bed. You know, if they want to go for out somewhere and I'm not able to, sometimes I have to say, no, I'm not, because it's more important that they have me alive and healthy than to be going to the cinema. You know, sometimes that's the way it is. And so, you know, that was a thing I had to learn. I had to learn how to look after myself. And it was the whole thing that I've gone through the depression. That journey of going through the depression and coming out the other end. And, you know, I remember at the time when I was really bad, my therapist said to me, you know, she says, you're going to be a better writer because of your experience of depression. And I was thinking, yeah, right. That's not much consolation to me at the moment when I'm flat on the ground. But she was right, because I became a better person and also a better writer, because, you know, it was like, you dig down deep, and it was a case of it came to the point one day where I was considering ending my life, and the only thing that stopped me was the fact that my kids, I was going through it in my head, I was going to do this and this and this and this, and I was picturing the funeral and my parents at the funeral and my kids, and then I was picturing their father coming and picture they would have to go and live with him. And that's what stopped me. The realization that they would have to go live with their dad stopped me from killing myself. I knew I had to be there for them. I had to stay alive for them. And that was a turning point. And thankfully, it was funny, because once I got past that stage of choosing to live, poems started to come. And I remember about 2 or 3 weeks after this, and I was sitting there one night, and suddenly this poem came to me, and the poem was about a daughter whose mother had committed suicide. And very, very stark poem, but after I wrote it, I thought, my God, you know, it was like someone was telling me through a poem what it would be like for my daughter if I had committed suicide. So, like, you know, that's what I find writing to be, a very kind of a sacred and nearly a mysterious thing, in that somewhere within me was telling me, this is how your daughter will feel if you kill yourself. You know, so in a way, writing has saved me.
Yeah, it can be very, it can be very spiritual at times. Even if a person doesn't believe in that sort of thing, I've known writers that later in their life, and they've been often atheists their entire lives, has said, listen, I got something spiritual from this, and I don't even believe in spirituality. They understand that there can be something very cosmic in that. And I think it's an incredible reversal of the tale you told, because oftentimes with people who have kids like myself, sometimes they can be such a stressful things because there's no manual on how to be a parent. You know, and you're saying that they survived, they sort of like saved you from that. And more times than not, parents are like, these kids are driving me there, not the other way around.
Well, that happens too. That happens too, you know. But yeah, it's well, like, you know, you love them, and it's like my GP said to me at the time, you know, I went to my, you know, and I was given out. I was saying, look, I can't even kill myself. You know, I'm trapped in this life, and I can't even kill myself because I have to stay alive for my kids, you know. And he was saying, you're not trapped. He said, you're choosing life. You're choosing to love. You know, you love your kids so much, you're choosing to live for them. He said, you're making the choice. And I was, you know, at the time, I kind of felt like as if I was trapped, but we all have choices. And thankfully, I found the resources in me to make the right choice. Now, you know, I went on antidepressants at the time. I know sometimes antidepressants get bad press, but for me, it saved my life. And they brought me back up because nothing else was working. Therapy wasn't working. Mindfulness wasn't working. Exercise, all these things that you're supposed to try, nothing was working. I was just down so low. Now, thankfully, I'm off the antidepressants now. But like for a year and a half, I was on them and they saved my life, you know. And like there can be a stigma around being on antidepressants.
Yes, I hear that a lot from writers.
Yeah.
And what I remind people is, and especially those artists in our circle that might struggle with this, what I remind them is that there are a series of things that people can do out there to combat or maybe to alleviate depression or maybe even to just to be able to put it to a side. The problem is that you often have to go to many things to find which one or two of those are going to work for you. It's not like depression is some kind of a building block and then you just put something on it and now everything is fine. You have to find which worked for you. In your instance, the drug, for however long you took it, was able to really help you and save your life. For others, they find it just made them sick in different ways and they had to go another avenue. As long as the person is continuing to explore, they're going to eventually find what works for them. Whatever cocktail that is, or it's a drug or a therapy, or some people even use writing as a therapy. But whatever they're using, as long as they haven't given up, they're in that fight to stay relevant in the world and to stay as healthy as possible.
Absolutely. It's just a matter of finding what works, and it's a combination of things. You know, for me now, thankfully, I was able to come off the antidepressants, but obviously I have other ways of keeping myself stable. You know, I have exercise, I go swimming, I do yoga, the writing, and taking time out for me as well, being selfish. And I think the kids now, they understand and they respect that. In fairness, they're very good with their teenagers now, but they do see that, you know, I need to look after myself, and they know how important that is for them.
It is. I hear this a lot as well, too, and it's part of the mantra of the show about making choices and being responsible for them. But also, if you're any kind of a caregiver at all, whether it's to other writers or just to, you know, to relatives and children, you need to give yourself permission, whether it's a part of the day or a day in the week, to where it's just about me. Because if you don't do that, you're going to harm all the things that you really love to do, because you're either going to hurt your psychological profile or you're going to mess up your health.
Absolutely. And that's kind of, you know, writing is so important in my life. I actually don't realize how I managed to survive 40 odd years without writing. But it's like it's intertwined in my life because, you know, there's the whole thing about creating something and releasing something. And then there's the joy. There's a joy when you're writing something, especially the first draft, and you're kind of in the zone. And it's like, for me, it's like I compare it to playing the piano, because I'm just at the keyboard on the computer and I'm just typing away. I can touch type. So it's like you're in the flow And that's brilliant because it's taking you out of the everyday stuff. And then when I have that first draft written, I get such joy out of that because it's like, oh, great, I've created something new. I've written a story, I've written a poem. So that joy as well, it sustains me. And then obviously you go back over because nothing comes out perfect, and you go back over your writing and you craft it, or you edit it or make changes, whatever you need to do. And then finally you get something that is fairly presentable, that can be sent out, can be submitted to a journal or whatever.
Yes.
And then there's the joy with, like, it's funny because I can see the whole time where, like, you know, there's so many different parts of writing that give me joy. There's the creating and the editing and the sending out. And then obviously if you get accepted, that adds more joy to it. And sometimes I find, like, you know, I remember one day before Christmas actually, and I was stressed at work, and I got an email from a work colleague, and it was stressing me out. And suddenly about half an hour later, I got another email from a publisher saying they wanted to publish my work. So, like, it's like, oh, you know, I had one email that really put me in bad form, and then I get this other email that's like, so it's like a balance. Do you know what I mean? That sometimes I find when I'm feeling down for whatever reason, something can happen in writing, whether it's creating something, whether it's an acceptance, that brings me back up again. So, you know, it's like, it's just like, it's such, for me, I suppose writing has, in a way, saved me. It's saved me. It keeps me going. And then I've been able to explore, for example, being gay, I've been able to explore that in my writing. First, unconsciously, and now, I suppose, in the last year or two, more consciously. And it's just such a gift for me to be able to do that, to explore being gay and what it means. And it's just, you know, it just gives me tremendous joy to be able to do that. And it's a release for me as well. And it's like, I would always have been a very quiet person, especially growing up. I always would have been considered an introvert and shy. So, you know, I grew up feeling that I wasn't being heard, because I wasn't able to express myself. So the writing is great for me because I can now express myself. I can put it on paper and I send it out, and it's been published. And sometimes I get people messaging me to say, oh, I read your poem, it really affected me. And then I was at a reading before Christmas. I did a poetry reading. And it was three people in the audience came up to me afterwards and asked me, could they have a copy of one of my poems that I had read, and it had resonated with them, and they actually wanted to give the poems to someone else. Three different people. So I thought, you know, wow, like, this is that's what it's all about. It's writing something that hopefully will resonate for other people.
And it can, and oftentimes it does. I preach this all the time on the show. And sometimes folks, they'll text me behind the scenes and go, Mark, you don't think you're, like, pushing this a little too far on how art can change the world? I'm like, hell no. I continue to hear examples all the time from people. This poem was shared and helped save somebody's life, or this person has never thought about something this before. I had someone tell me one time that a poem helped them from stop being a bigot about things. And they didn't want to clarify what that bigotry was, and that's fine. But just for them to say that alone, that's a serious thing. So, yes, the writing, whatever a person is willing to bravely share with the world, can make a gigantic difference. And changing the world doesn't mean that tomorrow all the world looks different. It could just be a tiny corner of the world someplace that you've never been to. You might never even meet that person. And now they're changed because you sat down for a little while, got your thoughts together, crafted something that was useful, sent it out to the world, and now somebody's been affected. That is what it's all about. And that's what makes an artist in many ways, in my opinion, also being a world changer. They can change somebody's world.
Absolutely. And that's the icing on the cake for me. If when I do send out something and I get feedback, and people telling me thank you, your poem, you know, has really stuck with me, that's the sheer joy of it. And like, and people say to me, like, your poetry is raw, it's honest, it's very brave, you know, and it is. And like, it's like, when I started writing poems, I didn't actually think I was writing poems, because they weren't like the poems that I would have studied in school. And they're like, my poems can be quite direct. But obviously they are poems because people are publishing them. So
yes,
I'm obviously
they
doing
are.
Right.
It's just a, so, it's a matter of, but, of style, whatever you came up with. And it's it can be a very personal artistic thing. I really like them mainly because of that exact reason, because that's how I prefer to write. And that's also how I prefer to interact with people. Being from the part of the country I am in the United States, we're very direct. We might be considered rude or, you know, even a bit hostile, but I'm okay with that because it's an honesty that I prefer to hear versus people couching things politely and you don't really know who they are. So I like that style, actually. So I'm always happy to have it in my journal aerial chart because I'm like, oh, God, there's somebody else out in the world that's doing some similar thing I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember I started writing poetry first. I was reading loads and loads and loads of poetry because I thought, you know, I have to try and find someone that writes like me because I don't think I'm writing poetry. I remember telling my therapist at the time, like, you know, I can't find anybody that writes poetry like I do. And, you know, she's, well, yeah, because nobody else is you. You can be who you are. You can only write your story. So, and that's what I do. And it's just like, you know, I can only be who I am in my writing. I kind of, you know, I sometimes think, oh, I wish I could write like so-and-so or so-and-so because they write beautiful stuff. And then I think, okay, well, I can only write who I am or what I am or what's in me. There's no point in me trying to pretend to be someone else.
Exactly. You know, it's a struggle that many writers go through internally. I know I did in the early past as well, and I've been doing this 37 years now. But I tell you, I didn't feel like I became the writer I was supposed to be until I reconciled exactly the approach that I wanted to do and stopped trying to copy others or mimic this or, you know, honor that. You have to make sure that once you know who you are as that person and what you want to try to get out, once you do that, that's really when you first started becoming a writer.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just, you know, as I remember saying to someone, I can only be who I am. And that's kind of something that last year it came to me one day and I thought, you know, that's exactly it. I can't be anybody else. I can't write the way I think someone expects me to write. I can just write my truth. And even sometimes my poems are fiction. It's the facts mightn't be true, but it's my truth, my emotional truth is what's true in all the poetry I write, whether it's based on something else or an image or a metaphor. It's basically it's the emotional truth that's coming through that's mine. And I think, you know, when I was looking back on my collection that's coming out in May, and I remember saying to myself, God, you know, I wish 2 years ago I would have been able to have read a book like that, because it's all about a woman in her 50s coming out as being gay. And it's like, I would have loved to have read something like that, you know. So it might have helped me come to terms with my own journey. So that's what I'm hoping this collection will do. And I think it was like I wanted to kind of, in writing the poems, yes, tell my own story, but also show to people, you know, it is hard to be gay. It is hard to come out as being gay. I was 50 when I realized that I was gay, and you know, like, it's not something you choose, and it's hard. And I think I just wanted to get that out there and get it across. And you know, there's not enough gay literature out there, in my opinion, certainly not in Ireland. And it needs to be talked about more. Being gay, but also it's about a woman's sexuality in her 50s, in midlife. I think sometimes we forget, like, you know, once a woman gets to whatever age, say 40, that's it. You know, she's dried up prune and doesn't even think about sex. And certainly when you separate, and not just when you separate, but say, you know, a woman who has lost her husband or has no partner. There's one thing that we could talk about a lot of things, especially in Ireland. We talk about a lot of stuff. But one thing that isn't talked about a lot is the loneliness that someone can feel when you haven't got a partner. You know, when you are faced with the fact that God knows when you'll ever have sex again, that's something we don't talk about enough, that it's lonely. for man and slowly for woman.
I imagine that's a difficult subject for a lot of people, mainly because our cultures, and I don't care what culture it is, they all seem to be the same on this subject. You reach a certain age, and now you just need to sit down in a rocking chair and spin some yarn or something and let the young people go at it, not realizing that
Absolutely.
It's still a big part of who we are as a human being. And I'm probably guilty of this of myself, because I remember when my father passed and my mother years later were wanting to go out to dating again, and I had issues with the whole process, and even with her talking about it, I found it uncomfortable. I found it a little bit sordid, and I never really gave enough respect that she was a woman trying to find her way again, because it was extremely difficult as a son, other than looking at all these guys as some potential rapist or something, not realizing that she has every right to go out there and try and define happiness again. But I'm one of those people that got married later and had children much later in life, and only then did I have a better perspective of what she was going through, and you know, I made sure that I apologized and tried to learn more, but there's not even a whole lot of books on that. It's just amazing how that's not really talked about enough, and it should be.
Absolutely, like we're all sexual beings, you know. That's part of who we are. It's a way of expressing it, just like writing is a way of expressing yourself. Your sexuality is a way of expressing yourself, and you know, it's just like, I suppose. It's just something that I feel very strongly about, and so when I am writing, sexuality and the physical senses comes up a lot in my writing, and I think it's important that it's written about and that it's read and that it's acknowledged, you know, because
I believe so as well, especially since if it's part of your story, the story of Anne. And if you're going to be authentic and if you're going to be putting this out there, then why not express all the things that you've noticed and that you're going through? You know, I do have a question, and it's not the easiest thing to probably the phrase, because of your story is in many ways for me so unique, and I haven't really heard it before. And I hear a lot, believe me, because I listen. But I was wondering, and maybe it's just being a curious guy or possibly a little bit of an artist as well, but do you feel that a lot of this is coming out more now because possibly there are things that you've lost over those years, because you remember you're just becoming to the understanding that you're gay around, you know, the age of 50, and not to put down your former life or to put down the fellow that used to be in your life, but it almost sounds like you're catching up on things that you might have missed on. I mean, without trying to sound rude.
That's you could look at it that way. I don't know. I think, like, I wouldn't be who I am today if I hadn't have got married, if I hadn't had kids, if I hadn't separated. I don't see it as catching up. I see it as me evolving as a person, and everything. I don't regret anything I've done in life. I don't regret getting married. I don't regret having kids. Any relationships that I had with men, I enjoyed. I enjoyed sex with men. I hope I'm allowed to say that.
Anyway. Yeah, sure.
Okay, good. you know, this. I don't know if I repressed my sexuality, or whether I just changed going through life. I think it was always there, but you know, it came when it was ready. I keep talking about therapy, but when I was going through the depression and I was in therapy, and I remember saying one day to my therapist, you know, I said to her, like, there's something in me and it wants to get out, but I don't know what it is, and I want to let it out because it's kind of nearly destroying me, but it won't come out, you know. And this was something I was struggling with, but I didn't know what the thing was inside me that wanted to come out. It possibly was the fact that being gay, maybe that's what wanted to come out. But she said to me at the time, she said, maybe it's not ready. Maybe if it came out all at once, it would be too much. It would overwhelm you. You know, so things happen when you're ready to deal with them. I really believe that. And everything that's gone before, it's maybe preparing the way for where I am now. So you know, I don't kind of look back and say, oh, I wish I had knew I was gay when I was 20 or whatever else, or life might have been different, or I wish I started writing when I was in 20 and I might be a best-selling author by now. It's not, that's not the way life is. It just, it evolves, and you go from A to B and you learn. And it's just like, I appreciate where I am now in life. I'm happy that I'm gay. I'm happy that I have two lovely kids. I'm okay with being single again. And yeah, when I first discovered that I was gay and I was in a relationship with a woman, it was wonderful. It was like being a teenager again. You know, it's like happy days. I was like on a complete high for about 8 months, and nothing could touch me. I was like, yay, you know. And it was like being like a teenager again. Unfortunately, the relationship didn't work out. But I suppose it probably was catching up a bit. But the thing is, like, it's like I wrote a poem about it, about being in love at 50, because being in love at 50 is hugely different than being in love when you're 20. Because you've got so much other stuff in your life at 50.
No doubt about it. Mm-hmm.
It's the whole thing, like, you know, when you're 20, you fall in love. Oh, happy days. Nothing's ever going to go wrong. Life is wonderful. But when you're 50, it's like, oh, will this relationship last? And then there's the fact, okay, I've got two children. How are they going to feel about mommy being in a relationship again? And then there's their father, and how is he going to react if he ever finds out that I'm in a relationship again? So it's like there's a lot more stuff in your life, responsibilities.
Yes, there really is. I used to laugh and say, when I was 20, it was easy to put the girl in the car and drive off. But when you're 50 and you're doing that, you have to also think about the car payment. Did I make that last week? What about that light bill coming up? I mean, these things happen in between of everything else, so you have a lot more on your mind. But, you know, I was wondering, Anne, I was wondering, that is becoming out and learning that you're gay, did that spur on the sexual evolution, or is it just entirely a separate subject from just you sexually evolving?
Sorry, I can't understand what you mean by that, though.
Well, I was just wondering, do you believe that you had a greater sexual awareness once you came out and you found that you were gay? Or was it just that as you're moving on in life, you're sexually evolving and being gay is a separate subject?
They're both tied in. I think one thing, after I separated from my husband and survived the first 2 to 3 years, I was incredibly lonely, and it wasn't just being on my own with two kids and having, you know, not having the emotional support there, not having another adult to talk to about the kids. But I did miss the physical element of not being in a relationship. At that time, I was like missing not being in a relationship with a man, but I missed the physical. I missed having sex, basically, to cut a long story short. And so, you know, I think, and then of course I evolved and I kind of came to realization that I am gay. So they're hand in hand. I suppose I've realized how important sex is to me and to, I hope my parents aren't listening to this, but anyway,
this is a family show still. Don't worry, parents, don't worry.
Oh God. But yeah, like, it's like, one thing, and I remember saying to someone, my therapist actually, you know, like, I really miss sex, but who can I tell? I can't tell anybody that I miss sex. It's just, why not? It's like a part of who you are. And that's the thing, is like that, it's a very important part of a relationship. So yeah, I missed having sex. And then when I got into a relationship with a woman, it was brilliant, because it was brilliant because, first of all, I was having sex with a woman and I loved it. And it was, I have to say, a much more spiritual experience for me having sex with a woman than it would have been having sex with a man. And that was down to a couple of things. Obviously, it was down to the fact that I'm gay, but I think it was also down to the fact that it had been 8 years since I'd had sex before. It was 8 years without any sex in my life. So obviously that was part of my experience. My first experience with a woman was that, yes, it was with a woman, happy days, but it was also, was this is the first time in 8 years that I've physically been with someone naked in bed. And that was part of the joy of it, because I had been lonely for so long. and suddenly I was with someone. And it was just like, it really does, you know, it gives life. It just brought great joy to my life. And I realized, you know, how, I want to say how empty, but how life is just easier when you have someone in your life and you have that physical contact as well as the emotional contact. It just brings more joy.
I agree. It's about that human connection that artists are trying to find, and even human beings are trying to find. And I think sometimes we forget, and I think the reason why we forget is because there's too much junk out there. There's too much stories on the TV and the movies and even in music that they put down a sex, or they downgrade it, or they make it something mechanical. They make it something that's even unholy, when it should be something that is beautiful and mutual and fulfilling. And if we keep it that way, then sex is no longer a dirty word. It's something natural and something, even if you believe in God, from God.
Absolutely. And it's like, and it's good for your health as well. Because I do suffer from back pain a lot. And I found when I was in a relationship and I was having lots of sex that had very little pain. You know, very little pain, you know, which, you know, it's like better than any painkiller
I'll take your word for that. I tried that with my wife, and she's like, are you crazy? This is why I have a baby in my stomach and my back's hurting because of sex. How's it more of it supposed to help me? So it, that whole thing didn't work for me as well.
Yeah, obviously it's making time for it, you know, it's hard, you know, when life is going on, it's hard to make time for it. As you know, when your life is busy with work and kids and everything else, I suppose for me, in a way, being separated was nearly a good thing, because there was times when the kids were with their father, so I had space that I could be with someone else. So yeah, it's hard to keep it fresh and keep it new. But I suppose for me, 8 years without it was enough. For it to be fresh, you know. So it's funny, my daughter said to me there recently, you know, because like she knew I was in a relationship, and then she was kind of sad when it didn't work out, and I became single again, and she said to me, oh, she says, "Mom, I hope you're not going to wait another 8 years before you get into another relationship."
Kids pick up, don't they? They pick up quickly.
Oh yeah. So I said, hopefully not, no.
Well, I would hopefully for you not either. So, yes, because otherwise your next book is going to be called 8 Years, and that's just not a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. No, definitely not. Yeah.
Well, tell me something about, if you can, because I don't know if you've ever visited America before or other countries, but do you think that that Ireland might be, I guess you could say, more restrictive or less open? Or just there's not a lot of things artistically about the gay experience in Ireland?
Ireland has changed an awful lot in the last few years. In the 1990s, I backpacked around the world. I was in Canada and I was in America, parts of the West Coast, Grand Canyon, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, that area of America. Okay. And then I went to Australia. I lived in Australia for a year. That was 1993-94, and it really opened my eyes hugely, because I wouldn't have known, I would have never have met a gay person in the 1990s in Ireland. In actual fact, it was like, if I had realized when I was 18 that I was lesbian, it wouldn't have been an option for me. Just that was not an option. So in Australia, it was like, you know, it was like, wow, in the 1990s, even then, people were much more open. I met people who were gay. I remember going to the gay pride parade in Sydney, and it was like, wow, it's just an awesome experience. And it just really opened my eyes. And like, you know, people could walk down the street, and two women could walk down the street holding hands in Sydney, or two men. That wouldn't happen in Ireland. Fast forward to now, we're lucky in Ireland. In 2015, the country voted to allow gay people to get married, and that's happening. So that's brilliant. It's a huge leap forward. It's great. It's great for the country, and you know, and it was voted in by a pretty high percentage. Having said that, it's still not easy to be gay here. I live in the country. I live in the west of Ireland, which is kind of, you know, it would be different than living in Dublin, for example. It's, you know, it's a country area. People it takes longer for people to change and to adjust to new realities. So, but having said that, I haven't come across any negative comments regarding me being gay. Now, I came out to my kids and they were fine. Like, you know, my son said, okay, you know, I accept it. Not overly happy with it, but I accept it. And my parents were good about it. My brothers, but anybody I've told nobody has been negative as such, really. Some people might have been a bit surprised or shocked initially, but there's been no negative reaction. And, you know, it's like, I was my worst critique. I kind of thought, you know, oh God, like, you know, everybody's going to hate me. Nobody speaks to me anymore because I'm gay and it's horrible. And it's terrible. And when the publicity was coming out for my book, I was terrified because it went up on on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I thought, shit, everybody in work is going to read this, or some people are going to read it and they're going to realize I'm gay. And I remember going into work the next morning after it being on Twitter, and and nobody said that to me. Nobody treated me any differently. You know, hello, hi, you know. And I thought, oh, okay, so maybe it is okay to be gay, because nobody is kind of like passing any smart comments or being snide or ignoring me. Life is continuing on, you know.
Well, I'm sure there's still people that feel that way out there, but it's becoming more and more of just a routine thing in life. And the more people are out, the less than, you know, they're in danger, and the more they're sort of educating people. I remember when I was on Off-Broadway, and I was getting some of my plays produced, and then later on I had the opportunity to direct one of them, the first and only time, by the way, and because I didn't like the experience, and I was happy to get it over with and kind of get it out of my system. And one of the actors, they came up to me, he goes, you know I'm gay, right? I go, like, yeah, and nobody cares. So what's your question? And he said, well, this is a straight part. I go, well, you're an actor. You have to be everybody, okay? So let's get on with this. But and it wasn't the person that was making an excuse. He just wanted to make sure I had understood that he was gay, and he had to, if not struggle, at least try to figure out how to interpret that particular role. But it was also the first time that it really got to me that, you know, I was so oblivious to all that and didn't even care that when someone came up to him, like, oh, yeah, I never really thought about that. You know, because in theater, there's a lot of gay people, and it's so normal and natural. I mean, I don't even care. I remember going to a bar off Broadway that the majority of the players and directors and everyone who hung out at, and almost the entire bar was gay, except for me, maybe in three people. and the actors were joking with me about, do you feel comfortable here? I'm like, well, the job is to connect with the actors and the director and make sure everybody's on the same page so that my play can be produced. And guess what? I don't write gay characters. I have no idea about that sort of thing. So that means that lots of gay people are going to be playing these roles. It's not hard to get used to. It's not really that difficult. It's just a question of how you want to approach the world. Do you want to get offended at the reality of the situation, or you want to be able to say, hey, folks can take whatever it is in their hearts and their lives, and they could put it forward into art, and they could be whoever they have to be or whoever they want to be. And that's when the world becomes a better place and a less hostile place, that, you know, you go home and, oh my God, everybody in my play is straight, but then everybody in real life who is playing them are gay. Big deal. Big deal. It's not that important.
Yeah, I suppose, like, you know, I had what would have been called internalized homophobia. So, you know, my greatest critic was myself. I suppose a bit like that with writing, my writing too. Like, you know, at the end of the day, really, nobody really minds or cares that I'm gay. But it was the struggle I had with myself to come to terms with it, and almost expecting everybody to be negative or to react negatively about it. Because, you know, it's like, it's society. Like I was born in the 1960s and, you know, grew up in the 70s and 80s, a very different Ireland, you know, than today. So just sex, being gay, that wasn't an option then. And that's what you grow up with. That's what you're internalizing that yourself. So unconsciously, you know, you're like, oh, this is horrible. Like, I'm not gay. I couldn't be gay. I'm not one of them. You know, this is what I remember saying to my therapist when she said to me, you know, maybe, you know, do you think straight women are attracted to other women? She said to me one day, and I was like, I don't know. Like, you know, just because I'm attracted to a woman doesn't mean I'm gay. You know, I can't be one of them. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it's like, woman is saying, I'm not anti-gay, but I'm not one of them either. Because, you know, it's just like, that's what I grew up with. I grew up, internalizing the messages that society were sending me in the 70s and 80s and 90s, that, you know, being gay is wrong. Like, to be homosexuality was a criminal offense here in Ireland until the early 1990s.
I believe a lot of countries still have those on the books tonight now. Yeah,
and it's heartbreaking to see that the countries that still is the case. You know, because it's hard enough for people to struggle themselves with their sexuality, but when you add that society adds this other layer and judgment, you know, that you know what you're doing, what you are, is wrong. It's intrinsically wrong. Then, you know, that makes it all the more difficult. And I know some people might say, oh, why do people talk about being gay so much nowadays? But people never talked about that when I was young. But we do, because, you know, it's been repressed for so long. And it's important that our voice is heard, you know. And like, it's like, I was talking to my brother recently, and he was in a relationship, and he's single now. And I said to him, I said, like, you know, I'm a single gay woman. And he said, yeah, I'm a single straight man. But I think being a single gay person is, you know, it's not the ordinary. It's not what people perceive to be the norm.
Yeah, you're supposed to be networking with every gay person on earth, and you have them speed dialed, ready to go. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, like, I've been fortunate in that those closest to me and those most important to me have accepted it. You know, they might not always be happy about it, but they have accepted it, you know.
Well, so, there's a big, I don't know if it's a big debate, but there's certainly an opinion going on out there that there's, you know, there's straight literature and there's gay literature. And I'm not really convinced that there are, because I can read literature that's been written by gay people. And even if at times it could be a bit graphic, and I mean graphic in the sense of going to places that I'm not normally going to in my life, there's still a lot that can be learned, because you'll find that besides the quote gay part, you got people that are dealing with families and illnesses and jobs and the world and all kinds of various perspectives. Some of the most religious people I've ever talked to were gay. So there's still an enormous amount of the world that's still in gay people. So to put it as gay literature versus straight literature, I don't really know if that's helpful, because what you might do by accident is cause a division that shouldn't be there. There shouldn't be a straight person saying, I can't really read that poem by the gay person because I'm not gay, so therefore I'm not going to be able to connect. And you'll artificially make a prejudice that shouldn't be there, because I don't think the person that says that is a bigot. But they might be made to be put into a corner just because they're made to believe that because it might have a gay element, or because the person wrote it as gay, that there's just simply no connection. There still is, because we're still human. We still have often many of the same experiences. So I always try to stay away from the gay literature title, because I honestly don't think it helps. In many ways, it hurts, because sometimes labels don't really tell the whole story.
Absolutely. And like, you know, I have poems where I'm talking about being with the woman, but like, I could be a man talking about being with a woman. Do you know what I mean? That poem can resonate with a man and his experience of being with a woman. Because I actually wrote a poem about that, and I showed it to a male writer friend, and he thought, oh, I can really get that. So, yeah, like, you know, like, I write about being gay, but I write an awful lot of other stuff. Like, I've written about 150 poems in the last 2 years, and about 50 of them maybe are about being gay, or about the gay experience. So there's 150 that aren't about being gay.
Sometimes you can't really tell anyway, so, as a reader, because you know how many times I read something, and then later on when I talk to them, they're like, "Yeah, I'm gay." I'm like, "Really? What the hell did I miss? Because I just read this stuff and I didn't catch any of that." So again, you don't really know, and sometimes it's not apparent. Sometimes it's written in a way that maybe only somebody else that's gay will understand, and maybe I or some other reader takes something different from it. There's nothing wrong with that. That's actually cool.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, we're all human, you know? Every one of us is human. We might be different genders or have a different sexual orientation, but we're all human. And we're here for a certain period of time to live out our lives. And, you know, at the end, what's our common denominator? Our common denominator, I think, is love. And I think we're all spiritual beings having a human experience. In my opinion,
and I agree. The more you talk to people, and especially as I do this as a writer, in my magazine or even on the show or you know behind the scenes, because people text me all the time about all kinds of stuff. You notice that there truly is a common denominator. It's not just some corny phrase that people use to make us all. You know, we are the world, and we're going to sing about Jesus in the forest. The truth of the matter is, there really is a common denominator. And you find, when you talk to people, that they often talk about just three or four things that affect them. Either love, or self-pity, or loneliness, and there's a difference. Or the joy of something that's happened. So there's only a few things that people really concentrate on that they struggle with. Even people who talk about joy struggle with joy, because sometimes they're not used to it. Sometimes they don't know how to make it continue. Sometimes it happened by accident and they love to figure out how to happen again. So you're amazed on how, no matter where they're from, some of the same things they're talking about. And I learned that more than ever before as an editor, because I used to have this secret tourism kind of feeling, like, why isn't this guy from Egypt talking about the Sphinx and the pyramids and the cool desert? All he's talking about is some girl breaking his heart. And then you realize, after a while of saying that to yourself, why is he supposed to be any different than you or anybody else? Because he's a man, he's got a girl who broke his heart, he's upset, he wanted to bring it to his family, that's not going to work out now, blah, blah, blah. He's known about the pyramids all his life, and he could care less. It's not a big thing to him. Breaking his heart, or having his heart broken, or maybe trying to build himself up again to something new, well, that's important. So, again, that's the commonality of people, because in the end, the few things I mentioned is what generally people struggle with. They don't really care about the Eiffel Tower or the Colosseum or the pyramids or, you know, kissing the Blarney Stone or something. Big deal. They really care about some of those essential elements that make them human and then in the end might make them successful.
Absolutely, and it's finding out what will give you strength to live the human experience, you know, and that's what it's all about. It's like we're all more similar to each other than we realize, you know, like this thing of ghettoizing people or saying, you know, she's gay, she's straight, or transgender, or whatever else, or she's coloured, or she's white. At the end of the day, we're all human, and there is a commonality there. And I think that's, you know, that for me, for writing, that's what I'm trying to tap into. I'm trying to, write about my own personal experience, but I'm also hoping that will resonate for someone else, or they will get something out of it. Because, like, I don't want to be writing poems about, oh, poor me and how awful my life is and blah, blah, blah. That's not going to help anybody. But it's about crafting something into a poem, making my personal experience universal and hopefully resonate with someone else.
And I believe you can do that when you're talking the most honestly about what you're feeling and what you're going through. People pick up honesty and authenticity more than anything else. And even if they don't understand all that you're saying or all that you're going through, they respect it. And once they respect it, they get over the obstacle of, you're a woman or you're gay or you're black or, you know, you're a leprechaun or whatever. They get over that and they find who you are. And once that happens, you've made the success happen. You've crossed a bridge. The art now becomes something that stays with them. And that's what becomes a very fine artist, when something you've done stays with somebody.
Absolutely. That's really what I want out of my writing at the end of the day, is that something I write will impact on someone else and maybe help them see something in a different way.
You know, I haven't got a chance to go to Ireland yet, and I've been all over the world.
Very welcome.
Yeah, I never got a chance to do that. But I was wondering, they'll probably think I'm just the ugly American, because if they got the Blarney Stone over there, I'm going to spray some hand sanitizer on it, because I just can't kiss something just for the heck of it, okay? I'm sorry. I got two kids. I know all about sanitizing yourself. I've gotten too many illnesses from these little guys.
I don't think you need the Blarney Stone, actually, Mark. I think you could talk quite well without it.
I think it's just funny, because it's one of those things that, like, you put on a list of, wow, this would be really cool to check out and to do.
Yeah.
I love castles, so that's another place I like to see one day, just for those reasons alone. But I like the lush landscape. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that, in many ways, some of the greatest and the finest writers are come out of Ireland for the last couple hundred years. I mean, I'm not putting aside the history of colonization or the forced religion of Christianity on a pre-Christian culture, or almost the near loss of the language of Gaelic in many instances.
Yeah.
And I actually try to inspire people to use some of those languages that are on the edge to get in my magazine. So we've done we've done Gaelic already. I know we've done Icelandic, and we've done a few of them. You know, I mean, because I'm not going to do French or Spanish or German, because, you know, there's like 100 million people that speak that. So it's not in danger of going away. But
no,
you know, Gaelic can, if we're not careful. And some of those American Indian languages, I'm trying to work on getting some folks to do that as well, just to be out there and for people to see that, and, you know, for it to have some staying power out there. But there is something beyond the funny stories of dragons and snakes and leprechauns and all of that that is magical about Ireland, and makes so many wonderful writers. I mean, I think many times it's just because there's been such a hard living and such a fight against the darkness in there. To me, it's very similar to Russia in many ways. You know, I used to always say that Ireland's like Russia, just with better alcohol. But it's not a coincidence that those two places form some fantastic writing and some incredible writers, because of what's going on in the culture and some of those things that they're fighting with or fighting even against that makes them stand out. And it doesn't even matter if it gets translated into another language. It still seems to have that power.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the Irish are great storytellers. We love telling a story.
And that's really helpful, too, because the better storyteller you are, oftentimes the better writer you can become, because you start forming things in your own character about what you want to say and gain some confidence, and then eventually you could put down something that, you know, that could last the test of time.
Absolutely.
So I'm not really too surprised about that. You were mentioning that you had some selected works that you'd like to read for us to be able to hear. Definitely ready if you're prepared to do that, especially with your wonderful accent. It makes the experience that much more exciting. I'm speaking like a giddy American, but all I could be is who I am, okay?
Okay. I'll read this one. It's called Metamorphosis, and it's... I don't know if you're familiar with Franz Kafka. He's a short story writer.
I certainly am. I'm thinking about doing a show on him one day, because he's very, very interesting.
He is. And I read his story, Metamorphosis, a couple of years back. And the whole concept of waking up one morning and finding that you've turned into a huge insect or cockroach or whatever you want to call it, that just grabbed my imagination. And it's a brilliant story, brilliant short story. So that idea of waking up one morning and finding yourself to be an insect just grabbed me. And so I wanted to use that in a poem, and to use it to show, I suppose, my transformation. So this is the poem. It's a short one. It's called Metamorphosis. I lie in her arms, breasts pressed against my back. Listen to her soft snores. She doesn't see the demon pest in me, its reddish brown shell, insect head and large black eyes. She doesn't feel its wax-coated exoskeleton or the claws attached to my legs. I maneuver myself out of bed, scurry towards the bathroom, into the shower. Boiling water lashes my vermin armor. I cry cockroach tears. Stiff wings dissolve. Antenna swirl down the drain. Six spindly legs become two again. So that's just, it's all about transformation. And
yes,
it's about,
I see the connection over there. I think the audience will hear that as well. And I really like that because it brings a better meaning now that we have a much fuller understanding of your journey on why you would want to pick that and write that or even speak that. Plus, it's also a first for the show. No one's ever said the word breast before, including me. So
really?
that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah. Okay. Will I read one more, or?
Oh, yes, that was great. I think the brevity really helps too to sort of like bring the message home. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'll read one more. And this one I wrote in a period of tremendous joy. It was about making love with a woman. Basically, it was discovering the joy of that, and it was shortly after having the experience, I wrote this poem. And it's called Maná na hÉireann. Maná na hÉireann is the Irish for women of Ireland.
Gotcha.
Okay, so Maná na hÉireann. To die, not having known the frenzy of making love with a woman, is to live without ever jumping over the bar of your crib. How could you not want to watch a woman fling her underwear on your bedroom floor, present you with soft skin for your nails and teeth to score like blades on dough? How could you not want to feel your edges slip into her hollows like a spoon folding flour into cake batter? How could you not want to hear her whimper crescendo to a jungle roar while your fingers move inside her? How could you not want a denouement to your play when secret stories leak onto ivory sheets, then tease tongues start the sequel? How could you not want to drag a woman to bed at 7 on a Saturday evening, rise at 2 on Sunday afternoon, sleep deprived and smelling like a marathon runner, race outside to tackle weedy flower beds, gleeful that soil will not rest in your clipped fingernails? So,
wow.
Yeah, that's...
It's just powerful. It certainly is natural. I don't think any real room for misinterpretation. So that's that's useful. And wow. In many ways, though, it to me, I like it because even though it might appear to sound graphic, it sounds quite ordinary in the sense of how a person would approach that. That situation in a very inquisitive and natural way, you know, and that's probably unusual for people to hear, thinking about a gay person and natural. But guess what? It is pretty natural, and when you think about it, and you get used to the concept, it doesn't seem so alien. And I think in the end, when we start learning that somebody who's different is not alien, it's just simply different, the world becomes an easier place to live, and people don't have to look at each other like they're strangers.
Absolutely. You know, it's a human experience. It might be the same as your human experience, But it's still a human experience.
Oh, no, I could see some of myself in that, so.
Yeah.
It's not too difficult.
That's the thing you see. But see, that's what, like, that men relate to that as much as a woman. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, this doesn't sound so gay.
No. Well, like, you know, it's universal. It's the joy of the physical experience with another human being, whether it's man or woman, and the love and the physical pleasure, you know, one can get regardless of sex. So, you know, that's like, when I wrote that, I was like madly in love, and I remember saying to someone, you know, it's great being a lesbian. She said, why? I said, because I get to have sex with women. You know, so yeah, that's that poem. That's what it's all about, really. You know.
Well, that might be a second title for a straight guy, then, I guess. If you look at it that way. But I like not only the honesty of the poem, but I like that it delivered exactly what you were trying to do, was the joy of the moment, or in this case, probably moments, because I think, what was it, like 10 hours that went by or something like that in the poem.
Yeah, yeah. But, I threw it for you.
Yeah, yeah. So that there's a lot of joy there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's making love with a woman is very different to making love with a man, because it tends to go on a long time.
yes, I know that, and yeah. I'm trying not to feel jealous here, okay?
Oh dear, yeah, you should feel jealous, but anyway, we'll go there.
That's what I'm told. I have a lot of gay friends who are in the theater. Yeah. Most of them, they're women, so they're always telling me some kind of a joke, and I'm like, okay, yeah, don't make me feel inadequate over here, please. I'm just a regular guy, okay? Sorry. Yeah. But yeah, yeah, I'm not really surprised. Other than you're able to put that into words, still make it joyful, still make it a piece of art, still make it a wonderful communication out to the world, especially to maybe somebody that might not be able or willing to come out of the closet, because a lot of my communication with people around the world is them having problems going forward in a society that literally could be so hostile that they could be literally jeopardizing their own safety. And, yep, and that's always heart-wrenching to hear. And I try to less be an American than simply be a compassionate person, because, you know, America, it's all about come out of the closet and don't worry about it, this, that, and whatever. And that might not always be the best prescription for somebody if they're in a society far away that's simply not ready for that. And we can debate all day long as human beings why they're not ready. But the truth of the matter is they're not ready. And until they are ready, someone coming out and venturing that way, it might not be a brave act. It could be almost a suicidal act. So
absolutely,
I don't really like to encourage that like I might do in America, because I don't want to be responsible for somebody's injury or death. I don't want to be crass or you know, very flippant about something that serious. And, of course, it has ramifications for that person's entire life, their family, maybe even their religion. So it's not as uncomplex as other more advanced societies are in that, on that subject. Sometimes you're literally dealing with the dark ages in some places, and you have to deal with artists that are figuring out a way to live their life as comfortably as possible and not want to separate themselves from the culture they've grown to love. And it's just so easy to bat them with a bunch of, you know, statements and questions and judgments, not in a bad way, just the judgments of why stay there then when you can live free somewhere else, when that's all they know or that's all they love or that's really where they want to stay, and regardless. So it can be an excruciating thing for some people, but you know, they could read something like that in the privacy of their own mind or phone, you know, or book, and say, yeah, that's what I'm getting out of it. I just can't tell everybody else.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm fortunate in that I live in a country that, you know, it's relatively safe to come out. I'm not going to be killed or put in prison. So, but that's not a luxury that everybody has, unfortunately. you know.
It's not, and that's why I always remind people when they come onto my journal, or if even they come onto this show, you know, if those are elements that they feel necessary to talk about, just please make sure that you understand that back home, that's going to get some kind of decent reception, because the link's out there, and you know that show will be everywhere. And if you're not ready for it, or if they're not ready for you, and this could be something political just as much as it could be something sexual, you could endanger yourself. I got a couple of friends from the Philippines, and I have to tell them this on a regular basis, and I worry that something can happen to them. Just one of them just got dragged to jail because she's a journalist writing about the administration. That's all she's doing, in jail, and how that affects her life. And I don't want to tell somebody as a writer, don't write stuff that you feel is true that needs to be out there. But, you know, I'm always worried about that there's consequences, and that unfortunately, especially when you have a family or friends, you're not the only one that's going to pay for them. So it's a real fine line, and sometimes on these things. And, you know, so I try to be cognizant of that on my journal and in the show, because I want people to be healthy and safe, and I want them to be able to speak their mind. But I understand that this is still a planet where that's not always possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to be careful and protect yourself, for, you know, first and foremost.
But every time somebody like you comes out there and does this and gets out there and becomes who they're supposed to be and writes so authentically and so beautifully, that still helps to fight against that one day, you know, that'll all vanish. I don't know what day that's going to be. I know every year things seem to get better in many aspects and many places around the world. I mean, but there's still places in the Middle East and in Africa and even parts of Eastern Europe where, you know, certain things can't be talked about without all kinds of names and accusations and even harm. But there's still more and more progress as time goes by that's not going to be the case. So, and I don't know which person is supposed to speak up and make that better. I know that has to happen, but, you know, who wants to push somebody and then something bad happens to them? Because I don't want to live with that. As a writer and as a human being, as a father and as a husband. But I know that, unfortunately, some people literally have to risk everything for the world to get better. And that's what really a hero is when they're willing to do that for the world, and they're jeopardizing everything that they're about and sacrificing all that they shouldn't have to sacrifice. That's a hero. And that's the real definition of a hero, not the one that we use here in America every 5 minutes. Everybody's a hero. I mean, because when everybody's a hero, yeah, then nobody's a hero. It gets a little carried away. But those people, well, those are the real heroes, and we don't hear enough about them, and we don't know enough about them, but we know one now. And so I thank you very much for coming on here and sharing such an incredible tale, one that I haven't heard before, and boy, I hear a lot of things. You know, even behind the scenes, I haven't heard this type of story. So it's incredible. It's out there. I'm hoping that you will share the names of these books that are coming out soon, and maybe some of the locations that people can buy them, because I imagine there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be interesting for some of the things that you've had to say and share and even read, so that they can also have a big part of that in their life as well. So if you can do that, please, that'll be a wonderful way to communicate again, you know, who Anne Walsh Donnelly is.
Okay, Mark. Yes, the poetry collection, the chapbook collection, it's called The Woman with an Owl Tattoo. And it's been published by Fly on the Wall Poetry Press. And it'll be available for pre-order in March. It will be launched in May. So it can be pre-ordered either on Amazon or also on the Fly on the Wall Poetry Press website. And then in September, my short story collection is coming out. It's going to be called Demise of the Undertaker's Wife. And that will be coming out with Blue Nib Publishing Company. That'll be in September.
Yeah, I'm actually familiar with them. They have a lot of good work out there. They really do. So that's great that you did that. I like that title a lot, too. It has a very has a real Irish ring to it.
Hasn't it?
I like that.
Yeah, it does. So that's my two collections coming out now soon. And I want to thank you, Mark, for having me, for asking me to come along and tell you my story. And it was great. Really, really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for listening to it.
Well, it was my honor. It's really the show's privilege to have different stories to really bring to people's attention, so that that interview is the same. That interview is just, you know, based on all the safe topics, so to speak. Sometimes we just have to just let it out there and see how it goes. And I feel that that's the best way to have these kind of shows, because the most of humanity comes out. And that's why this show is called Strength to Be Human, because, you know, you need to be strength to be human. If you have the kind of story that Anne has, that it can't be explained by science and it can't be understood by religion, only by love and by grace, and just by the struggle of every day to be who you're supposed to be. And hopefully more people are going to cling to that and learn something from that, and maybe come up with their own struggle and their own story to find the love and the joy that we're all looking for, even if we don't always want to publicly admit it. God bless you, Anne, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.